Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Well, it's another week. It's the second week of Advent as we approach this the end of 2020, as everyone's counting down as if the flip of the calendar on December 31st will change anything. It won't.
At this point, I think people are holding on to hope with, you know, their fingernails.
Blind, irrational hope. Yes, I know. I'm staring down the long barrel of the early part of 2021. So let's talk about something hopeful, and that's Advent and all that sort of thing. But before we do, let's kind of talk about what's been happening for us this past week. Lucy, who we've mentioned before, has a whole bunch of food allergies, had a food challenge.
Yeah, that was on, like, what, Tuesday, I
think? Yes, that was this past Tuesday. So, for those who aren't familiar, what's a food challenge?
Okay, so they can do the skin prick tests, and they can do the, like, blood test to tell whether or not you react to a food. But really, the gold standard is, can you eat it?
Can you eat it and not have anaphylactic shock?
Right, and not have anaphylaxis. And of course, obviously, you want to do this in the doctor's office so that if you do have an anaphylactic reaction, they can treat it. You've got the medical professionals right there.
Right.
And, you know, if things worst comes to worst, the doctor's office is right across the street from the hospital.
Right.
Very reassuring.
God forbid, but yes.
I mean, we've never had a serious, scary...
I don't think they would do it unless they had a strong feeling that.
Well, no, actually, what they do is they did a skin prick test back in January, I think, or February, and her reactions to quite a few of her allergens were very small, and so they were very hopeful about doing a food challenge. It just didn't happen because everything locked down.
Right.
But the way they do it is they actually do a skin prick, another skin prick test the day of the food challenge. So we go in, they do the prick of all the different things that she's allergic to on her arm, and then they measure whether the bumps come up. And if the bumps are under a certain size, then they'll go ahead and let her eat the food. Now, we actually had a failed food challenge a couple weeks ago. We went in to do milk, and her reaction to the milk was just a little bit too big, and so they wouldn't let us actually do the challenge. So the doctor then at that point told me, what I wish they had told me before, which is go ahead and bring in samples of all of the foods, because when you do a food challenge, you bring in the food that they're going to eat. They don't provide the food.
Right.
They're not, I guess, you know, they're not caterers.
Right.
So he said to bring in some of everything, and they'd test for everything, and then they'd have her actually eat the thing that had the least reaction, that looked the most promising.
Because the other time was you had to go home because you couldn't do one that you only because
we brought milk and she couldn't do milk, and so we got to go home and we just wasted a whole trip, a whole morning.
Right.
So that was very frustrating because you have to wait for 15 minutes as it is for the skin pricks to like...
Right. So this time you brought milk, egg,
nuts, corn. Bread, everything. Yep. We brought everything.
Okay.
The egg looked good, which was, I was happy that the doctor decided to go with egg because I'd actually taken the time to fry an egg for her and, you know, or scramble an egg.
Yeah.
So I had like a container of cooked egg in the bag with me and I was kind of hoping that they would go with that one, and they did. And, she actually liked the taste of the scrambled egg. I made sure to put salt on it because nobody wants to eat unsalted scrambled eggs. That would be gross.
But you had to cook it with oil instead of butter so they didn't get it mixed.
Right. So because we were doing they want it in as pure a form as possible.
Right.
Just the thing that they're allergic to, not like all sorts of other ingredients. For one thing, they do it by weight. So they start off with a very small, like, quarter ounce, and then they go up to a half an ounce, and then three quarters of an ounce, or something like that. I don't remember the
actual. So it takes time.
Right. And you have to do 15 minutes for each bite. And they, you know, they check her to make sure she's not breaking out in hives or anything. And then they do another slightly bigger, and then slightly bigger, and then slightly bigger. And then by the time you're done, they're like, congratulations, you can now eat eggs. And we were like, yes. So, yeah, now she can officially eat eggs, and she's very excited. We celebrated by having tuna salad,
mm-hmm.
which has mayonnaise, which has eggs in it. And right. previously, she loves tuna salad, but previously I've had to make it with
veganaise,
which is
now we don't have to buy veganaise. Yay!
And so we made a list of all the different eggy foods that we make separately, or we leave the egg out for her. And
we've been making this list all week of what's the next thing, what would be the big thing that she could have next, like if we could get one more, what would it be? And we're kind of vacillating between milk and wheat. Like, what would make life easier more? Like, getting wheat would be big, because there's so much, you know, flour, like in to use it to make a roux, or the expensive bread,
and just being able to buy like feeder
regular
plain
bread,
or able to have the yeah. baked goods that everybody else is eating,
or things like soy sauce, which you don't know is unless you buy the gluten free soy sauce, which is we have to get from Amazon because our grocery store doesn't carry it. Soy sauce has wheat in it. Didn't know that, but now we do. Yeah, so it can be really tricky. Yeah, and not to mention, if she gets wheat, it means she can receive the Eucharist in under the form of the bread, which would make her life, the rest of her life, easier. Yes, you can go to the priest at the beginning of Mass and explain, I have a wheat allergy, I cannot have wheat, I can't even have gluten. She wouldn't be able to have gluten-free host, because those are still wheat. It's not the gluten, it's the wheat. And then they would have to do the cup, and then even right now, in a COVID, receiving from a cup is problematic the way that they do it. So
I suppose if she really were unable to have wheat, we could talk to our pastor and he would prepare a second cup just for her and bring it down to her, and she yeah. could receive. I mean, this would not be a complete barrier right. for her ever receiving communion, because the church does not want people to not receive communion, but it would be a special accommodation, which she wouldn't necessarily be able to expect at every Mass.
Well, every Mass at our church, because we have lots of visiting priests who come in, and every time you'd come to Mass, I was thinking about this, you'd have to let them know we're here, so prepare the extra cup, because you don't want him to prepare the extra cup and you're not there for, as we'll be talking about in a minute, there are times when you're unexpectedly not there. And so, yeah, getting wheat would be a big deal.
I suspect, though, that we're probably going to end up doing dairy next time, which yeah. would also be really awesome, because
that would be great too.
Dairy-free, like yogurt and milk and all of those things are hard to find and expensive. And
right, not to mention the making eggs with milk, like scrambled eggs with milk is good, or you know all the things that you cook with butter that you can't. If she's like so often we have to make two separate dishes.
Well, actually. I'll make a confession. She's been having butter.
Well, yeah,
for a while, which is why I think that milk is a really good possibility for her, because she can.
Well, they did tell you to start giving her baked goods with milk and egg.
Right. She's been having baked goods with milk and egg for several years now.
Right.
So she can tolerate eggs and milk when they're baked, but she has accidentally had vegetables cooked in butter many times, to the point where I don't even bother. I don't even bother. Like,
yeah.
if there's a little bit of butter on like the squash or something, she eats it. She's fine. She's never had a problem with it. So,
but like the curry, not having to make two separate things of curry, you know, the other wheat thing was the pasta. Gluten free rice pasta is so stinking expensive, and she only eats a little bit of it. And so every time I make it, like if I don't make enough, she'll want more. But if I make enough, she doesn't eat it all, and I end up throwing half of it away anyway. So it would be nice to just give her regular pasta. Anyway, that we're going on and on and on on that, so that's fine. So hopefully, say a prayer for us that everything keeps looking good. We got noticed like a year and a half ago that she could eat something. Was it wheat?
No. I don't even want to go into it. It's a saga. It's a saga.
That's a whole saga of a whole different thing that we won't get into. But yeah, so it's been this has been a long time coming, and it looks like she's starting to grow out of some of the allergies, which is great. The other thing we want to mention was that what's really cool over the past couple of weeks, Sophia has an iPad, one of my old iPads that we give her as her work computer, her school computer. Bella has a
Chromebook.
Thank you. Word not coming to head. She has a Chrome. Bella has a Chromebook that I got for free, as a review copy for something. And then I gave Sophie this old iPad with an Apple Pencil, and she's been using it for her regular work. And just like not that long ago, she found an app called Paper that she started drawing in, and she's been they're all Star Wars drawings. She's been drawing figures out of this Star Wars characters book.
Yeah, she's been doing Star Wars characters in like the margins of her school book notebooks for a while now.
Yes,
especially Mandalorian helmets.
She's been doing
like small character sketches, but yeah, this is kind of a new step up to the Apple Pencil, is allowing her to add color and shading.
The color and shading is fantastic. Like she started drawing Baby Yoda, and then she started drawing the landscape around him of all these trees, and she got really into drawing the trees. And like, so it's really a landscape with Baby Yoda in the front, but the trees are really fantastic with lichen and fungus and stuff. She's done so really, like, her art has really blossomed with having this medium to work with. So I was really excited by that. It was really cool. So
I've got a friend who does a lot of drawing with the Apple Pencil that she shares on Facebook. So it's kind of an interesting medium.
I was showing them Greg Willits's comic strip that he does with a different app called Procreate, and it's a layer program, so you can layer things in and work on different layers at a time, and you know, get other ones to go away, and you can even load a photo in and trace it.
That would be cool.
I think I should show her how to do that, because that would be really good. So that was really cool. So that's one thing that's been going on. And then, so I made a reference earlier about if you don't get to go to Mass. So last week we talked about how it was the first time in 8 months that our entire family was able to go to Mass together as one group. And that was awesome and fantastic. And so this was going to be the second week in a row. Yay!
Was going to be.
We got halfway to our parish. And who said something? I think
Isabella said, "Oh, I forgot my mask." And of course, there were no spares in the car.
The spares in the other car.
All the extra ones in the van had been used and then taken inside.
Right.
And then there was a chorus.
Oh, I forgot mine too. Yes, three of them forgot their masks.
Now, we had a crazy morning because it was St. Nicholas Day, and so they had
new socks and chocolate coins.
Socks and chocolate coins, and I had made cinnamon rolls, which, I mean, I kind of fell down because I was quickly trying to get the cinnamon rolls done before we went to Mass. And I was rushing to actually get my ready for Mass. And so everybody was already in the car by the time I was leaving and grabbing my mask to go. And I just didn't because I was very focused on like making sure kids had like coats and boots and socks and
right
stuff.
But
because we had snow and it was colder.
Yeah. But yeah. So three of them didn't have masks, and our church is not down the street. It's 15 minutes away, and we were, by the time we got home, it was, let's see, so Mass starts at 10:30, and I looked at the clock, it was 10:26. There was, like, if we went back, we would have walked in. I looked at the clock, too, as we would have walked in after the gospel, seven of us. That would have been disruptive, and I just didn't want to do that. I knew that we had time to come into the office, turn on the TV and watch the stream, and we wouldn't miss any.
Well, the other thing is that our parish has registration, so we couldn't go to a later Mass because we take up an entire pew, and you have to pre-register for Masses. So
there's no place
like
around here that you can just walk into the church,
right?
These days, and just go to Mass,
right? So this is sort of
this is the way it is now.
Yeah, if you miss your registered slot,
You're out. You got to watch the stream. Yeah. So that's what we did today. It just feels like two steps forward, one step back.
It was a temporary setback, and yes. Now we will be super vigilant about making sure everyone has their masks, because we will have learned our lesson.
And let's move the masks back to the van. Some of the spares.
Yeah.
Anyway. Then the other thing I did today was, for the first time in many years, in a number of years, I haven't done this in a while, I put outdoor Christmas lights up.
I can't remember when you did them last.
Yeah, I mean, well, it was when the two trees that flanked the door were, like, 6 feet tall, because that was when I could reach them. That was the only trees. The things I did was wind the around those two trees. I didn't put them in all the bushes, but those trees are now 15 feet at this point. So I now I went to Home Depot the other day, got some more lights, and just strung them all into the bushes, and it looks really nice.
It looks very cheerful.
You know what I wanted to do, and I didn't have enough lights, or I need another extension cord to do it too, is I want that little tree that the kids planted, the evergreen.
Yes.
Years ago.
They didn't plant it, they found it.
So years ago, there was a little evergreen sprout that popped up on the edge of our sidewalk.
Little teeny tiny spruce sproutling.
Yeah. And, I mean, nowhere where you would actually plant a tree. It's like, it looks wonky where it is, but it's fine. And they protected it. They didn't want me to mow over it. They put rocks around it and everything. And
they being Isabella.
Yeah, of course. And so she protected it. And so I let it grow. And it's been growing for a number of years. And now it's 5 feet tall.
Oh, it's more than that. It's at least six.
It's not tall than me.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Okay. Anyway.
You haven't been out there recently.
Whatever. So but it's gotten tall enough where it's like it could be a Christmas tree. So I wanted to run an extension cord down to it and wrap that too. And
I was thinking we should maybe get some of those outdoor glass ornaments and put them on it, because it is really cute. It's very Christmas tree-ish. It's a spruce.
Yeah. So I think, I have to get back over to Home Depot, and we're gonna have to get the tree anyway. So, which apparently trees are selling like hotcakes these days.
I've seen so many people on Facebook saying, I've never been a kind of person who decorates early, but I need some Christmas cheer in my life right now.
Yes.
I think that feeling is fairly universal.
That's one of the reasons I wanted to put the lights out on the, because I just needed some Christmas cheer.
I mean, I'm not quite ready actually for like a tree and decorations in the house yet. I'm not.
Right.
But outdoor lights are cool.
We don't want to wait too long. We may end up with the Charlie Brown tree.
I love Charlie Brown trees, so I have no problem with that.
Ugh, you and the Charlie Brown scraggly trees. Anyway, let's move on. stay tuned, folks. We may get a Charlie Brown tree. So let's talk about some food. I'm still doing a lot of the cooking, although you're doing more. Like you mentioned, you made the cinnamon rolls today.
I made cinnamon rolls. Unfortunately, what I'm discovering is that something like cinnamon rolls is pretty much like, I can do that and then I'm done.
Right. You made a loaf of bread yesterday.
The loaf of bread plus making the dough for the cinnamon buns was really more than I should have done, and I was feeling it
right
last night.
So I'm still doing.
The thing I hate about recovery is that like you don't realize when you've done more than you should have until you've done more than you should have, and you're like, oh, that was a mistake.
Well, it's always like when you're sick, you get to a point of like getting better where you think I'm better, I can do things, and you get up and you're like, I'm not that much better. I need to lay down again. Like you just feel well enough that you feel like you can get up and do stuff, but you're not really that well yet.
Yeah, that's pretty much me. I hate it. I hate it because it's now, you know,
that's 3 weeks now.
3 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll get there.
It's just, I mean, I knew it was going to be slow. It's abdominal surgery. You know,
those muscles
take a long time to heal.
Yep. So last week I decided to make a Sicilian gravy for pasta. So, which is not, it wasn't truly a Sicilian gravy, because a Sicilian gravy has like two or three different.
You got to explain to the non-New Englanders that Sicilian gravy is not either brown or white. It's red sauce.
It's pasta sauce.
It's red sauce. It's like just normal red sauce.
Spaghetti sauce with meat in it. It's not normal red sauce. It is spaghetti sauce with meat in it.
Yeah, that's what most people think of as normal spaghetti
sauce.
So
when the Sicilians make Sunday gravy, this is what they call it. It usually has something like chuck roast or something that kind of like a beef that falls apart. Okay, so like a hunk of meat and sausage and meatballs. Okay, so it'll have a few things in it. I didn't do that. I had sausages and that was fine. But I wanted to give one of the reasons we don't usually make sauce with meat in it is because, as we've said before, the sauce goes into the fridge, you know, the leftovers, and the kids eat from it for weeks even, you know, because it's just sauce, right?
And frequently when I make a new pot of sauce, I dump the leftovers from the old pot into it. And so it's sort of
it's the everlasting sauce.
And it gives extra flavor.
Well, yeah.
But if you have meat in it, I would not do that with meat. That would be sketchy and
right
and scary and gross because, like, you mean though technically, Vic, you're reheating it and boiling it again? No, it's just no.
Well, when meat goes bad, reheating it isn't going to save the bad.
Right.
So yeah, we've avoided it. But I wanted to do something to get a little more flavor, a little more substance into it. So what I did was I made the sauce, and then I took the sausages, I browned the sausages, and then I put some of the sauce in a baking dish with the sausages in the oven and let that bake in there and get some of that sausage flavor into it. And all of the kids were like, what are you doing? Like, why are you ruining the sausages? Was basically what they were.
Yes. What did you do to our sausages?
Right.
Now, mind you, all of our kids love Italian sausages.
Well, they love grilled Italian sausages.
They
like the indoor Italian sausages.
Yeah, they.
There is a wide gap between the grilled meats and the skillet meats or broiled meats that we are able to do in the house. Now they're good. Grilled sausages are great and they're fine. You can do them just as they are without sauce. That's fine. But the last time we made the indoor sausages, they were not as excited about. I wasn't excited by them. I wanted to do something more, and I thought this would give something more to them. And I was right.
For the most part. But what you forgot is that some of our kids do not like red sauce.
4 out of 5, including one or two who don't really like red sauce, really enjoyed the sausages. And in fact, had sauce on their pasta when they would normally not have sauce on their pasta. From this meat infused. So, I was right.
But next time you need to remember a child who does not like red sauce.
I will keep one or two sausages out
and keep some segregated sausages.
Right. Well, actually, that actually might work better because the dish I used was the sauce. There was a lot of sausages, so I wasn't able to get as much sauce in there as I wanted. Like they would have eaten a lot more of that sauce if I had more sauce in it. You see what I'm saying? So if I take a few sausages out, set them aside, there'll be more room for sauce.
There you go.
So
everybody wins.
Everybody wins. So that was good. The other thing I made this week, or I made a bunch of things, but the other thing I wanted to talk about that I made this week is they had roast chicken on sale. So I got a nice, huge, nearly 8-pound roast chicken, which is rare. We need a big, one of the reasons we don't have roast chicken more often is because they're usually teeny tiny and wicked expensive. But they had them on sale after Thanksgiving because nobody was buying roast chicken. Nobody was buying chickens to roast the week after turkey.
I guess not.
So they had them on sale. I bought one.
Except us.
Hey, I'm desperate. So the way I like to make roast chicken, actually indoors or outdoors, is spatchcocked, which not everybody knows what that is.
It sounds weird. Spatchcock sounds like you're doing something inappropriate to that chicken.
So
he was not doing anything inappropriate to the chicken, I promise you.
I'm not sure the chicken would appreciate it, but the chicken doesn't care anymore. Spatchcocking is basically butterflying. It's another way of saying it, but it's not as fun to say. Is you cut the backbone out of it. So you're cutting, you use kitchen shears, and you cut the backbone out. So you cut on either side of it, and then you lay it flat, and you kind of break the keel bone or the breastbone so that it lies flat, and you flip it so that the skin is up. And I cooked it on a baking tray with a rack so that it wasn't sitting in the juices. And now usually I'd want to brine it, but I don't have space. Like we talked before about the space for brining. So I thought I'd do what I did with the turkey, which is I made an herb butter and put it all under the skin again. And then I put herbs and oil on the outside of the skin. And did I do the flip? I think I did the flip too.
I have no idea.
I'm pretty sure I did. So I think I started it breast down and then flipped it. Yes, I did. I flipped it at, you know, partway through. And yes, it was very juicy.
It was very, very juicy.
Right. With no brine. I'm like, okay, this is what I'm going to do from now on. This is, I'm going to do this way.
I will let you do the roast chickens from now on, because I don't like roasting chickens.
Yeah. I mean, it was on, again, it was on sale. You know, next time it'll be chicken thighs again and we'll have that. But this worked out really well. I was really happy with that. So, really good. So, let's talk about what we've been reading and watching. We've been watching it. So we've mentioned that we've watched The Mandalorian as a family, but we haven't really talked about the show itself.
We haven't. And partly because
it's hard to talk about without spoilers.
No spoilers. I know a lot of my friends and family even don't watch it like the day it comes, as it comes out. They like, you know, wait and play catch up. And so I don't want to like spoil anything. And there's a lot of really great stuff that's been going on that I wouldn't want to spoil.
Well, let's talk a little bit about like the bigger picture, which is it is clear that The Mandalorian is Star Wars now. It is the best Star Wars out there right now.
Even people who don't like Star Wars, as a rule, love The Mandalorian.
Yes. And people who are watching The Mandalorian now are going, I need to go back and watch Clone Wars and Rebels animated series in order to get all that extra goodness that is obviously being referenced in this show.
At least some of the more...
Right. Some of the people more interested in that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, I've had people ask about it.
The nice thing about it is that you can watch The Mandalorian knowing almost nothing about the Star Wars universe, like maybe not even having seen all the movies.
Who is that?
Plenty of people.
I don't want to know those people.
It is perfectly watchable as a standalone series if you've not seen a single Star Wars movie.
Right.
I would lay money on that because it's such a good story.
Right. It is strong enough that you don't need to know the lore of Star Wars.
I mean, if you do know it,
it adds so much.
There's layers upon layers upon layers of cool stuff that's going on.
Oh my gosh. In the most recent one.
Spoilers.
No. There's so many layers. That's what I'm saying. It's like there's layer upon layer. Like if you played some of the Star Wars video games back in the 90s, there's a layer there for you. You don't need to know this, you know, in order to enjoy it. But there's a layer that there's a thing in there for you where you go, no way. In fact, I said it in the episode while it was airing. I'm like, no way. That's what
you
it
did.
Thing.
It was.
Yes.
It was cute.
But you could tell. So the two guys who are really running the show now are Jon Favreau, who, you know, from the, you know, Avengers, and, you know, all those movies, who's both an actor and a director, and Dave Filoni, who was handpicked by George Lucas to do the Clone Wars animated series and has basically been in charge of the animated stuff. And he is the brain of George Lucas. He has all of that lore, all of that passion for Star
Wars. Well, most of all, Dave Filoni is like super Star Wars geeky fanboy.
Right. They both are, really.
Right. But I mean, that's what I really think that brings that comes to the show is that fan passion, all the cool things from the movies that only the really geeky people noticed, and they're bringing them into the show.
These guys are about my age, and they were there in 1979, I think it was, when Boba Fett was just an action figure. We hadn't even seen him on screen yet, and he was just an action figure you can get from Kenner. And
I have to say that this is one reason why I never really understood
yes.
all the boys who were into Boba Fett, because I'm like,
on screen,
he's hardly in the movie. Why are you guys freaking out about him? I do not understand this phenomenon at all.
In the movies, he's this bad guy who captures Han Solo and gives him to Jabba the Hutt and then dies ignominiously, we think, at the hands of a guy who's blind and accidentally knocks him into the Sarlacc pit. And that's that. And like,
so why then I'm thinking,
why does everybody think Boba Fett's so cool?
Why then does my friend Neil like think that the sun rises and sets on Boba Fett and the rest of the Mandalorians? I do not understand. I mean,
because there was this other element. And so,
in fact, until the show The Mandalorian, I did not know what the heck a Mandalorian was. But my friend Neil is like raving about Mandalorians and how cool they are.
What Filoni and Favreau have done, they've really injected their passion in for Star Wars, the story itself. See, J.J. Abrams was a fan, and Rian Johnson was kind of a fan. I'm not sure how much of a fan he was, but these are guys who were fans. But they were passionate about their vision for Star Wars, whereas Favreau and Filoni come across as they're passionate for the shared vision that fans have had, that they want to continue. And that's one of the reasons why, like, the sequel trilogy we just got was not as great as it could have been, partly because of the tug of war between Rian Johnson and J.J. Abrams over the characters in those three movies. But whereas Favreau and Filoni are really, they're like, let's get rid of all that nonsense. We're going to go right into what makes Star Wars great.
The characters and the storytelling.
Yes.
I mean, really, because when it comes down to it, one of the things that came out in conversations I was having about The Mandalorian this week is how good it is at just storytelling.
Right.
Just
focused
telling,
storytelling,
right.
By the way.
Somebody in a Star Wars fan group that we're in suggested that, wouldn't it be better if the episodes were an hour long and we could have a chance to have more story time with these
more
secondary
B-plots.
Characters, yeah. B-plots? And I thought, no, that would ruin it. That would make it awful. I do not want B-plots. I want Mando and the child on a quest
right
through the universe. This is cool.
Stay focused on the story that we care about.
It's a very tightly scripted, tightly written, very... And not just action-packed, but also, like, full of character moments and,
yes.
Like...
And each episode is only as long as it needs to be to tell that part of the story. If it's a half hour, if it's 48 minutes, it's just as long as it needs to be.
There's no filler because they don't have a slot, TV
right.
slot to fill.
And you're not left going, oh, if only they had more time to tell that part of the story. They have as much time as they need, and they take it. So, yeah. Oh, man. So The Mandalorian, and just this past episode that we're talking about now, it was so good. I mean, it really takes it to another level, and
oh yeah,
who knows where it's going from here. So it's pretty awesome. So
in line with that,
yes,
I spent the afternoon in bed recovering from making cinnamon rolls and bread, and also slipping on the ice this morning.
Oh, yes. Well, not you didn't fall, but you kind of caught yourself.
I didn't fall, but I caught myself, which also
twinges.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I basically fell asleep while you were out stringing Christmas lights, or no, you were running an errand.
Right.
And I decided that I needed to just take myself to bed. I finished my novel and then I binge watched Star Wars Rebels. I finished season 2 finally. Yay! And I'm on to season 3.
Yes, and season 4 is a short season, so just so you know. So it's not going to be, you're not going to take you long to catch up.
So I'm finally, like, The Mandalorian is making me interested in, like, catching up and watching, like, more of this.
Because there's connections.
Yeah.
And there are connections, I think, coming, which are going to be big ones. So maybe not even this season, but they're coming. All right, from the heights, The Mandalorian, to the lows.
Oh, no.
So I was looking for something to watch the other night, and so I was on Netflix, and I saw they have a Netflix original movie starring Bruce Willis. I'm like,
oh, no.
I like Bruce Willis.
And, you know, there are some good Netflix original content, so I suppose it's worth taking a gamble.
Yes, and I didn't have to pay anything for it. So this movie's called Hard Kill. Let me just say, it's a hard pass. This movie was so bad. I didn't even finish it. I got like half an hour in. It was.
That makes me sad.
Every
cliche. I love Bruce Willis.
Every action movie cliche. Every dumb line said by a cardboard cutout character. There was the wisecracking guy in the crew who's irreverent about everything. There's the brother and sister, and the sister is a hard, you know, case who, you know, guys always want to hit on because she's beautiful, but I'm more than just my looks. I'm the action hero. And the brother, I didn't even see it, but I know the brother dies. Like, I didn't see it, but of course he dies because that's his role in the movie. And then there's the old friend who hires on the leader of this group to do a job. It's easy money. You just have to come and do the job. And we're old friends, so come on.
What could possibly go wrong?
Of course the old friend betrays him. Of course it's not as easy as that. And then there's like this whole, like, moment where we're in this confrontation, and all someone has to do is like shoot the guy who's standing right in front of you, and it's all over. The movie's done. We can go home. But no, they're like, for some reason, nobody does the obvious thing because we have to have keep a movie going, you know? Oh my gosh, it was so bad. And the premise was dumb as a box of rocks.
Although I have to say that every once in a while, one of those like really so bad movies becomes a cult classic.
Well, yes.
Like it's so bad that it's good.
But it's not so bad it's good. It's just bad.
Because like, okay, I have to say that like talking about so bad it's good, Bruce Willis, Hudson Hawk.
Hudson Hawk.
It's oh my gosh. Like it's a horrible movie, except it's awesome.
Because Bruce Willis in it is awesome. The problem with this movie, there wasn't enough Bruce Willis.
Right.
Bruce Willis was here to be on the title card for Netflix to get people to click play. That was his role. He was the boss who they were protecting, and so he stayed in this room over there.
Oh, no.
Yes. If Bruce Willis was in the lead, then it would be fun. There would be Bruce Willis chewing the scenery and spitting out, knowing, like, looking at the camera as he spits out these stupid lines going, I know they're stupid, but come on.
Okay, that explains it then. If Bruce Willis isn't the lead, then forget about it.
Exactly.
Right.
So instead...
Because Bruce Willis can pull off really, really bad movies make them watchable.
I've watched plenty of bad Bruce Willis movies that were really good because Bruce Willis was the lead. So instead I went and watched Thunderball starring Sean Connery, 1965, James Bond.
Thunderball.
Oh my gosh. So good. So there are things that he does in that movie that you could never get away with in movies today. Like, forcing himself to, you know, on this woman, kissing her until she gives in to his, you know, charms. And I'm like, yeah, that would not fly today. There's no way.
No way.
Yeah. But just so, so Bond, so cheesy James Bondy in the Bahamas and just sharks. And it was awesome. It was really good. So Thunderball is good. But so the other thing I watched, though, was last night I watched Mulan, the live action. So when Disney...
The remake.
Yes. So when back in September, Disney put it on Disney Plus, and it was like $30 to watch it.
Right.
I am so glad I didn't pay $30. It wasn't bad, but there's no way I would have been mad if I'd paid $30 to watch it. It was all right. It was... I remember reading reviews that were highly critical of it, like things didn't make sense. Why is this character doing that? It was very... In some ways, it was very Chinese. Chinese action movies... don't often make sense to Westerners.
Yeah, that's true.
Chinese storytelling is culturally dependent.
Right. There's a sensibility that sometimes I'm like, they're really pretty to look at and they're fun to watch. But if you're looking, trying to figure out the storyline, like looking for a coherent story, it doesn't always.
Or the motivations of why does a character do this thing? Or why does some great Jackie Chan movies were like that. There's even Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which was like an Oscar winner, wasn't it? I think it was
probably
it was a huge phenomenon. But even that had many elements where you kind of scratch your head going, I'm not sure exactly what's going on, but this is really pretty to look at and really I like the characters and that sort of thing. So Mulan, I don't know why they made this movie. Like the animated version had the little dragon and you had a little bit of humor. You had a little bit of the serious.
See, this was actually what I was kind of looking forward to. I didn't watch it with you, but I get completely lost on the like cute little talking animal, funny, humorous
you don't like
things.
Talking animals.
I don't like all that stuff. So I was really looking forward to non-animated Mulan because we could cut out all that.
Okay. So maybe you would like this more than I did.
Maybe I would.
Yeah. I like some of it. Highly predictable. I mean, it's the story of a girl who bucks the tradition and does, you know, girls can't do that. So she goes out and does it and she's the hero. And I mean, everyone knows the story of Mulan in fact, I don't remember how much this differs from the animated.
But that's where I'm curious. I mean, we've also read some picture book versions that are based more closely on
the actual
Chinese.
So there is a
story.
Real like a historical legend.
Right, right. It is actually
Disney.
A Chinese historical. It's like historical fiction.
Right. The one thing that the historical legend has is that Mulan goes home and she does what they say only men can do, and then she goes and does what only women can do, which is be a wife and mother. I suppose that's a controversial statement these days. Anyway, in Disney, no, there's no hint of a romantic relationship. there is talk of like arranged marriages, but at the end of it, there's no question that she's going to get married, or doesn't come up at all. I'm not going to ruin the ending for you if you haven't seen it yet, but it is not the traditional story. So it's kind of in that way, but I like the characters. There's some great actors and actresses, Chinese American actors and actresses I've enjoyed in a lot of other things that are in it. Donnie, what is his name? He was in Rogue One. Donnie Yen? Is that his name? No. Anyway, he's also Ip Man. He's a great Chinese actor who was in it, and a bunch of stuff like that. And it looked pretty. It looked really great. But lots of people like running up walls and running along the tops of reeds. That sort of like wire work that you see in a lot of these movies. So it was okay. All right. You wanted to talk about a book.
I did. So I found this book on a book list of, as I recall, it was a list of like looking at the books that are most assigned in school. Like you could say that in the United States, To Kill a Mockingbird is one of the most often assigned novels in like high school level. Like everybody's read.
Nearly everybody has to read To Kill a Mockingbird or Catcher in the Rye or that sort of thing.
Right, that sort of thing. So this was a list of like, what are those novels in other countries? And some of them looked interesting. Some of them didn't look all that interesting. But this one was, because we're on our African kick recently with the kids, I thought I'd pick up something for myself. And it looked interesting. It's called The River and the Source. And it's by a Kenyan novelist, and it's set in Kenya. Her name is Margaret
Ogola.
Ogola. I didn't want to mess up her name. And it starts with the birth of a girl who's the daughter of the chief in this tribe, like, with no contact with Western civilization. You don't really know what time it is. It's kind of timeless because they're living in the tribe. And she's this really wonderful, strong character. She's beautiful, but she's also hardworking and just a character that's like solid. And she, her father dismisses like seven suitors. And then this young chieftain, his dad just died and now he's the chief and he has to get married. And he comes and he courts her, and her father requires an incredible bride price of 30 cows and he pays it without even haggling. And then they go and they sort of have this love match, and he never wants to marry a second wife, despite all the pressure from all of the tribal elders.
Because they practice polygamy.
Because they practice polygamy. It's unheard of for a chief not to have multiple wives, but he loves her so much. Her name is Akoko. And then he dies, and she's left as a widow, and her son, who's the chief, dies tragically, and then her other son dies, and she's left with just her daughter, who is married, and then her daughter loses several children and also becomes a widow. And so they're left with only two children in the third generation of her grandkids. And her daughter does not like widowhood, and she eventually hears about a Christian missionary who's come through the village, and she goes and follows it, and she discovers Christianity, the religion of widows and orphans, and she falls in love with it. And then she comes back and like brings her mother to the mission along with the two grandkids, and they all become Christians. And so then it follows their family, Okoko's daughter, and then her daughter, and then her daughter's children.
Right.
And so that brings you up to contemporary 20th century, late 20th century Kenya. Her oldest son, actually, I forgot to mention, dies in World War I. He wants to go see the wide world, and he ends up dying. And the first contact they have really with the outside world is when the government officials come to inform them of his death.
Mm.
And you go through the Kenyan independence, and her granddaughter becomes a doctor, and
you told me this has like a lot of Catholic sensibility to it.
Right. The mission that they go to is a Catholic mission, and Okoko's grandson becomes first a priest and then later a bishop. Her daughter's conversion is not just a pro forma conversion. Like, she has this really deep sensibility, this relationship with especially the Angelus is her favorite prayer. And then Akoko, when more tragedy befalls, she always takes her pain, her tragedy to adoration, to the Eucharist, to Christ. And she becomes, like, as strong as she was as a tribal woman, she becomes this really strong, rock solid Christian who is the source, in a way, in the metaphor of the title, the river and the source. She's the source, and you see all of her descendants, these really strong young men and women who have her strength of character.
Right.
And I really loved not all of them do. There are also weak characters, and there's foibles and follies, and there's a whole bunch of different characters. And yet there's this sense of faith and family and the importance of character and hard work. One of the granddaughters or great-granddaughters actually becomes an Opus Dei numerary.
Well, yeah.
And it turns out that actually the author was a member of Opus Dei.
Yeah, she and her husband were members of Opus Dei. She and her husband were medical doctors.
Right, which I see in actually the final generation that you follow. There's the grandson, great grandson, who's a medical doctor and who marries a woman who's a medical doctor. And so you see in those characters very much the author's medical experience.
Well, she was also
very detailed
chief advisor to the Kenyan Bishops Conference on Family and Health and Family Life.
And I really feel like this novel, which I'm kind of impressed, is like widely read in schools. It's on the national exams. Right.
It's not just a book that's in Catholic schools. This is I saw it online. It said 2 million copies of this book have been sold in Kenya, and it's on the required reading list for Kenyan secondary schools.
It was a really great novel. Yeah. Like, in the first couple chapters were kind of slow. There was a lot of foreign words as they're trying to describe the tribal culture and customs. And I got a little bit bogged down, but I'm really glad I pushed through those first like 3 or 4 chapters, because then after that it became a page turner. Like, I'm staying up until 3 o'clock in the morning and I can't put this book down kind of book. Just really, really good.
There's a sequel, by the way.
I might have to read it if I can get a hold of it. Now, this book was hard to find. I got it through interlibrary loan from one of the local Christian universities.
And you can get it on as a Kindle.
Oh.
It's so like $9 on Amazon for a Kindle for The River and the Source.
Okay. I highly recommend it. It's worth $9. Definitely.
And the sequel's $6.
Oh.
So
I'm there.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was like, it was really up there in terms of like just being a really solid story that it was gripping.
Cool.
Yeah.
So from the heights again to the lows.
Oh no. Another low?
Well, a little disappointing. It's not terrible. So one of the best books of the past 10 years, obviously, was this. A lot of people agreed. I think it was 10 years. It's not longer than 10 years. Was Ready Player One by Ernest Cline.
Oh, I loved Ready Player One. I've read it several times.
Such a good book. Got made into a movie.
The movie was only okay.
Yeah. But the book was great. And so Cline wrote a second novel called Armada. Wasn't a sequel. Wasn't as good. It was kind of forgettable. It was, a character who, it was actually almost like the plot of The Last Starfighter, a guy who could play video games who has to take that into real life to fight aliens.
Which is actually sort of part of Ready Player One.
It's also in Ready Player One. Yes, The Last Starfighter. So he finally got around to writing a sequel to Ready Player One called Ready Player Two. And I'm about a third of the way through, maybe a little more than that. And I can look at it right here. In fact, it's right here in front of me. I can look. But I have to say, it is grim. What has happened to Wade Watts is not good. Like, winning was bad for him.
I mean, I suppose I could see that there are some stories where, like, like Neverending Story, getting of his wishes granted was a bad thing.
No, but this, like, he turns into a bad person and it's like a slog. And like, well, for one thing, the writing isn't great. Like for a lot of the first quarter of the book is just exposition, just description of Wade's of the world and description of all the things Wade has done. Like not what he's like description of what's going on in the plot. There's no plot. There's no plot for the first third of the book or 20% of the book. It's just like, oh, and
I have to say that when I saw that Hugh had released a book called Ready Player Two, I did not have high hopes because this did not seem like a book that wanted a sequel.
Right.
It seemed like a book that really wanted to be a standalone.
Well, what it made Ready Player One great was that it was a quest.
Okay. Yes.
Classic quest. And that it tapped into the pop culture sensibilities of a whole generation, both the people who lived through the 80s, but also people for whom the 80s is a nostalgia thing. There's a lot of younger people for whom the 80s is cool nostalgia.
Well, not true nostalgia, but like...
retro, you know, it's...
Retro cool.
Like the 50s were for people who lived in the 80s. You know, there was a retro cool thing. So...
Like Happy Days and all that stuff, right?
Exactly. And Sinatra and all that sort of stuff. And it was very... His avatar was Parsifal. So, you know, Parsifal in the group H and Shoto and Artemis were working together. They were the underdogs. They were trying to overcome the evil IOI to win the prize. And they were the true heirs of Halliday, who had set up the quest. And they were the ones who should win. And they would do, you know, all this stuff like this. But now, like, Wade is, he's the most powerful man in the world, and he's kind of pathetic. Like, as the head of GSS, or, you know, the company that runs the Oasis, he's all-powerful. There are no limits on him. There's no laws that he can't get away with breaking. There's no limits to how much money he has to spend. There's literally no limits on him, which makes him an intensely boring character. Like, there's no limitation. The only limitation is that he's lonely and sad.
I mean, I suppose you could, in theory, create a really interesting...
You could. A good writer could do that.
An interesting story, but it doesn't...
A better writer could do that.
But that's not what this is.
I think Ernest Cline had a book in him, and that was Ready Player One. I'll finish the book. Maybe it gets better. Again, like I said, I'm only a third of the way through, so, I mean, it might be a premature... This first third is not that great. And I've had books where I wasn't enjoying the first part of it and it really turned around and I really enjoyed it. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen, but it could. So I'll finish it out and let everyone know what I think. But so far, not so good.
Mm.
No, I'm sad. Let's finish up by talking about the second week of Advent. The second Sunday of Advent, which is what today is as we record.
Yes, it is the second Sunday of Advent.
So just as a reminder, the readings included, so the gospel was John in the desert, right? And there was also Peter. I forgot to pull up the USECB's readings of the day. And that is the Memorial of St. Ambrose. That's doesn't seem right. They already have the Monday readings up. It's only 10 o'clock at night. Okay. Anyway. Now I can't find it. The Bible and Liturgy, maybe? Nope. Books of the Bible? Never mind.
Get a daily.
Well, yeah. This is makes compelling gospel. So this is the daily reading. It's tomorrow. So. Oh, here. Here we go. This is. I got it. Oh, no, that's the podcast. So this is... Tomorrow is St. Ambrose. That's cool. I always forget St. Ambrose. All right, here it is. Second Sunday of Advent. So the first reading is from Isaiah. Oh, that's right. It was Isaiah 40. The voice in the desert crying out.
Comfort, the way give the comfort Lord. To my people.
Yes. The second reading is from 2 Peter. A thousand years are like a day with the Lord. And one day is like a thousand years. And then the Gospel of Mark, the very beginning of the Gospel of Mark, where the... quote from Isaiah is brought back, and John is in the desert, and he says, "One mightier than I is coming after me. I am not worthy to stoop and loosen the thongs of his sandals. I have baptized you with water. He will baptize you with the Holy Spirit." So there's two things that Father Michael, our pastor, said that really struck with me in his homily. One, he asked the question, what are the mountains in our lives that we need to bring low? So, it, in fact, I think it was from Peter, where it talked about, is it Peter?
Isaiah.
Isaiah talks about the broad valley, the every mountain and hill shall be made low, every valley shall be filled in to make a straight path for the Lord. And so there are mountains and valleys in our lives that need to be leveled to make a straight path for the Lord right to us and for us to him. So he, you know, what are the mountains in our lives that we need to bring low? And he kind of talked about it. Like, do we have addiction? Do we have anger and a spirit of revenge? Do we have a spirit of envy? You know, what are the things in your lives that we need to address? And the other thing he mentioned, which I thought was really good, was sometimes the desert is the place where we encounter God. So a desert in our lives is a place where things are stripped away. All the extras, all the distractions are stripped away. And that's where we encounter God. But sometimes the desert, for Jesus and for us, is a place where we encounter temptation. Because we've lost so many of our comforts and so many of the things that insulate us and distract us, that when the devil comes along with a temptation to satisfy that lack that we feel, we jump at it. So like the desert came to Jesus and said, hey, you seem hungry. Call up some bread. Make some bread for yourself.
They're not necessarily mutually exclusive. Sometimes the same desert can be both.
Well, you can open door number one, which has God behind it, or door number two, which has the temptation from the devil behind it.
Or maybe you're tempted and then encounter God.
Or, right. Or you overcome, like Jesus did, overcame the temptation and then was...
comforted by angels? Comforted
by angels. Right. Well, that wasn't in this week's gospel, but it's...
No, but it's...
Different gospel, yeah. It's good.
It's good to remember that, like, sometimes just, you know, when you're finding yourself in that desert, in that moment, in that temptation, it's not necessarily the end of the story.
Exactly, yeah. The temptation, whether you fall for it or not, is not the end of the story, because God is there.
Which actually kind of reminds me a little bit of something really good that I read, and I cannot remember who it was by or where I read it, but it was an essay in which the author talked about hearing the first homily of a young Jesuit priest, like his first mass and his first homily as a priest, as a newly ordained priest. And he said something that really struck her and was what she needed to hear at that moment, which is that sometimes God meets us in the place of our greatest fears.
Mm.
And so she took that very literally, and she went to adoration, and she sat there staring up at the crucifix and talked to God about her greatest fears, just explained them to him, talked about how she felt, just poured it all out to him and let him be there with her in that fear. And she said it was amazingly freeing. And her fear didn't go away. Like, the troubles in her life didn't go away immediately. Right. But she said over the next few months, it did eventually, like, resolve itself to the point where this fear was not her greatest controlling fear anymore. And that kind of strikes me as being similar to this idea of being in the desert. Like, when we're stripped open and we let God into those places where we are most afraid to let him in, when we're most vulnerable, that's really where he wants to come and heal those fears and touch us and be with us. And so I guess when you think about, like, what are the mountains that need to be leveled, maybe that is those greatest fears are, like, the places where we need to ask God, come level this mountain because I can't do it.
Yeah, level the mountain, fill the valley. Let me give me a straight path to walk.
Right, because these are obstacles in our lives that keep us from... Mm-hmm, from mm-hmm. following him and doing his will. But that's kind of a scary thought to, like,
right,
identify your greatest fear and then bare your soul and talk about it with somebody else.
Well, I mean, isn't that the benefit of the desert? Is it strips, like I said, it strips everything away so that all you have is the just you and God and you as you are.
And, you know, this year especially, so many people are in so much pain and so much suffering, so lonely and scared. This pandemic has leveled everyone. And I think that all of us feel this year more than anything that we're living in the desert. I know a lot of people have said something to the effect of, it feels like we've been living in Lent since March, right, and we haven't got out of it yet.
We haven't got an Easter yet.
It doesn't feel like it, which is maybe why people are, like you said at the beginning of the podcast, really looking forward to a new year, a chance at a new beginning. We need some new hope.
That kind of reminds me of something, actually. The boys were listening. I was playing some Christmas music earlier, and so the song, It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year. And Ben says, oh, it really is. And Anthony's like, no, not really. Easter's the most wonderful time of the year. And so they were having this theological debate about which is the more important holy day. And Anthony's point was that Easter is when Jesus comes and saves us. So that's the most wonderful time of the year. And Ben's like, well, we wouldn't have Easter if Jesus isn't born at Christmas. So they were going back and forth. But I think I agree with you. I think we have been living in a long Lent that has now become Advent. And I think people are feeling some hope. I think it's one of the reasons why people want to decorate for Christmas and play Christmas music.
Or at least trying to find some hope.
Right. They're trying to create a sense of the Christmas spirit. And I think even in secular circles, that's happening. People want to, they're searching for something. And this is an evangelization opportunity to provide some of that vision. But it's this Advent is an opportunity to really walk through it. The first week of Advent is wait. This week is the word I would say is prepare. Prepare the way. Make straight his paths. You know, prepare ourselves to receive him. You know, we're waiting. We're preparing, and soon enough, you know, on Christmas, he comes, and. And life isn't going to become perfect on December 26th, but it's renewal. It's just renewal of hope, renewal of, you know.
I read something from Pope Benedict this week that I'd read before, but it really struck me in a new way. He has a little book about reflections on liturgy throughout the year, and the one about Advent, he talks about how the liturgical year is the church looking through her memories, and with every liturgical season, we remember the things that God has done in history, but we also, as human beings, as, you know, finite mortal people, we live the church year through the liturgy and through our customs, so that our own experiences of Christmas or Easter are part of that remembering, mm-hmm. so that we join our own experiences, our own memories of our childhood, of our children's childhood, and those become a part of God entering in, God coming and dwelling with us, so that our own memories become part of the corporate church memory and part of the experience of incarnation.
Right.
So that, like, things like buying Christmas trees and drinking hot cocoa and hanging Christmas lights and making Christmas cookies are really incarnation.
And listening to cheesy Christmas carols.
And listening to cheesy Christmas carols. And rolling your eyes at the other person's taste, yes, in cheesy Christmas carols are incarnational. Like, this is how God enters into our lives. And this is how we enter into the liturgy and the memory of the church. It's not just what we do in church on Sunday for an hour a week. It's also making that into something that we bring with us into our homes, into our work, right, into everything.
And celebrating Christmas with these secular, somewhat Christmas traditions is not opposed to celebrating Christmas, you know, and Advent. You know, I don't make that clear distinction that some folks like want to make, but there's the bringing those things together. They're not opposed to one another. I think that's what Pope Benedict was
saying. Pope Benedict, yeah, he's saying that what we do culturally and liturgically is all part of, it's one thing. It's not separate. Like, there's not church Christmas and secular Christmas.
Right.
Really.
It's just Christmas.
It's just Christmas.
Right.
And if we feel that there's a disconnect, maybe the disconnect is in us and we need to bring the two together, like, mm-hmm. in the way that we live, the way that we ask God into our lives. But it's not,
right,
It's not separate.
You must embrace the Christmas songs like Santa Baby and Wham's Last Christmas and Mariah Carey. I admit now to the whole world on this podcast, I like those Christmas songs. I did turn off Santa Baby when it came on.
You did? Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I think that that's also incarnational. Fighting over Christmas music is a tradition.
It is a tradition. Yes. All right. Let's wrap it up. So we do want to, of course, before we wrap up, is take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Jarrett B, Guy C, David B, Erica P, and Susan S. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest and our mission of exploring the intersection of faith and pop culture. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. We'd love to hear from you, what you your thoughts on anything we've discussed. You can let us know by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And I'm going to put links to the books we talked about and some of the movies, not all of them, in our show notes on sqpn.com because Hardkill does not deserve a link. If you can, we would really appreciate it. We haven't gotten one in a while, but if you could write a review of the show at Apple Podcasts and share the podcast with your friends, help us grow this community of listeners. And as the community grows, the show gets better. It's a fact. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.